case is, but also more importantly, to bring Alet's words and voice to people. This is a collection of 10 years of his writing, of his communications from prison, of his social media posts, of his statements to the prosecutor. And it really is worth reading for anyone who's interested in ideas of justice, who, you know, he's a very experimental writer and thinker, who is very vulnerable when he writes and very open. And so I think it's an important book for anyone to read. But we're going to D.C. Tomorrow, and we'll be speaking at Georgetown and at the National Press Club, and then after that to Chicago, to Seattle, to San Francisco in the Bay Area, to L.A., to Houston, and back. And
if people want to get information about the tour and if you're coming to their city, where can they go?
We've put up a link with all the sites, with all the events.
We'll link to it on democracynow.org. I want to thank you both for being with us. Sherif Abdelkaddous, Democracy Now! Correspondent, Mehdi Masr, reporter in Egypt, and Sena Seif, writer, filmmaker, activist, imprisoned herself for more than 3 years, sister of Ala Abdel Fattah. His book is just out. You have not yet been defeated. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
April is Jazz Appreciation Month, and KBOO Community Radio is very proud to be the first FM station in the state of Oregon to program jazz. Let's celebrate KBOO's diverse jazz programming and the jocks who volunteer their talent to share their love of jazz music. Jazz Appreciation Month, or JAM as it's affectionately known, represents a sweet spot in the lives of KBOO's music lovers. So join us on Wednesdays, noon to 4, and Saturdays, 2 to 5, throughout the month of April, as we toast America's greatest art form here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, PDX and TriMet announce they will no longer be requiring masks for travelers. A professor who refused to use a transgender student's pronouns wins a $400,000 settlement. And in international news, the war in Ukraine continues as Moscow launches a new offensive in the Donbass region. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, April 19th, 2022. KBOO is currently in our spring membership drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu. The Transportation Security Administration announced it will no longer enforce its security directives and emergency amendment requiring masks on public transportation and transportation hubs. Portland International Airport said it will no longer be enforcing the federal mask requirement after a judge struck down the Biden administration's mask mandate for public transportation on Monday. The Port of Portland said in a statement, quote, "Local TSA just advised us they will no longer be enforcing the directive that requires masking in the airport. To that end, people in the airport are not required to wear a face covering," end quote. After the ruling, major airlines have announced an end to their mask requirements, including Alaska Airlines, United, Southwest, and Delta. TriMet announced Tuesday morning that it would also switch to a masks optional rule on its buses and trains. The agency said it might take a few days to fully update all the signs and announcements on TriMet vehicles. The rule change also applies to the Portland streetcar. TriMet added that they will continue to have masks available on board for those who want them. Ride-hailing services Uber and Lyft also lifted mask requirements in their vehicles on Tuesday. Uber noted that the CDC still recommends wearing a mask if an individual has personal risk factors or if the person lives in an area with high transmission of COVID-19. The move comes just one day after a federal judge in Florida struck down the mask mandate for planes, trains, buses, and other public transportation. U.S. District Judge Catherine Kimball Mazel for the Middle District of Florida said the policy was unlawful and ruled that the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention had overstepped its legal authority by imposing the mask mandate. The next potential legal move by the Biden administration would be to ask an appeals court to issue an emergency stay to block the judge's ruling. But the Justice Department didn't immediately make that move on Monday, allowing the mandate to be lifted and people to begin going maskless on planes. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki said that it could take several days for the Justice Department to challenge the ruling, and that the administration believes the mask mandate should have remained in place. While the judge's ruling ended the mask mandate just days before it was set to expire, public health experts have argued a decision not to appeal risks setting a dangerous precedent for how public health decisions are made in the future. A new process is underway in Oregon to identify areas at high risk for wildfires and to map the level of risk. A set of rules entitled Wildfire Risk Mapping and Wildland-Urban Interface Identification Criteria is being offered to the public for commentary. The criteria will be used to build a map intended to classify the wildfire risk on properties across the state as being at extreme, high, moderate, low, or no risk. The state is also crafting new building codes and zoning requirements to protect homes in high fire risk areas. The areas at highest risk of burning in wildfires are known as the Wildland-Urban Interface, or WUI. The rules include a definition of the WUI as an area where structures or other human developments, quote, meet or intermingle with wildlands or vegetative fuels, end quote. They also established a process through which each tax lot in the state of Oregon is assigned one of five wildfire risk classes. A tax lot with an assignment of high or extreme wildfire risk that is also identified in the geographic area of the WUI is subject to additional requirements. Owners will be required to implement defensible space measures on said property, as determined by upcoming rules coming from the Office of the State Fire Marshal. The rules include requirements to clear flammable trees and brush around homes, as well as mandates that new homes use fire-resistant home hardening measures and less flammable materials. There are also rules that define the appeal process for property owners who want to challenge the state's wildfire risk classification of their tax lot. The rulemaking process stems from a wildfire preparedness package Oregon lawmakers passed last year in response to the wildfires that burned around 4,000 structures and more than a million acres in the state in 2020. The process has sparked controversy. Some want a very small WUI to minimize those exposed to any kind of regulation. On the other hand, some property owners hope to be in the WUI because there are grants available to help people pay for home hardening requirements. The Oregon Department of Forestry estimates about 900,000 tax lots may be within the Wildland-Urban Interface, and about 230,000 of those tax lots may be classified as being at extreme or high risk of wildfire. The state has until June 30th to develop a wildfire risk map and alert property owners in extreme or high fire risk areas. The public is being asked to comment on the new rules at virtual meetings scheduled this week, and Oregonians can also send in comments by email until May 2nd. The Board of Forestry is scheduled to vote on the final rules in June. A small public university in Ohio agreed last week to pay one of its professors $400,000 after the university rebuked him for refusing to use a transgender student's preferred pronouns. Shawnee State University in Portsmouth, Ohio, warned philosophy professor Nicholas Merriweather in 2018 about not using the students' preferred pronouns. In response, Merriweather, who is an evangelical Christian, filed a federal lawsuit against the university, arguing that officials violated his constitutional rights by compelling him to speak in a way that contradicts his religious beliefs. The $400,000 settlement follows a three-year legal battle that ended last year, with the Sixth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals ruling in the professor's favor. Merriweather's legal representation, the Alliance Defending Freedom, applauded the settlement. The ADF, a conservative Christian law firm based in Arizona, has a decades-long track record of litigating against LGBTQ rights and has been labeled an anti-LGBTQ hate group by the Southern Poverty Law Center. Over the last 10 years, the ADF's funding has more than doubled, from over $34.5 million in 2011 to more than $76 million in 2021. Merriweather's settlement included a payout for his attorney fees and assurance from the university that he will, quote, never be mandated to use pronouns, including if a student requests pronouns that conflict with his or her biological sex, end quote. Shawnee State said in a statement last week that it adamantly denies the university deprived Dr. Merriweather of his free speech rights or his rights to freely exercise his religion, and said the settlement was an economic decision. The university added, quote, we continue to stand behind a student's right to a discrimination-free learning environment, as well as the rights of faculty, visitors, students, and employees to freely express their ideas and beliefs. Over the course of this lawsuit, it became clear that the case was being used to advance divisive social and political agendas at a cost to the university and its students. That cost is better spent on fulfilling Shawnee State's mission of service to our students, families, and community. End quote. Lucky Charms cereal is under investigation by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration after more than 100 customers claimed the cereal made them sick. The FDA said Saturday that it had received over 100 complaints related to Lucky Charms so far this year. Questions about a possible link between the cases of reported illness and the cereal began after hundreds of consumers posted on food safety website I Was Poisoned with complaints of nausea, diarrhea, and vomiting. According to the platform, over 3,000 people have posted complaints as of Monday. General Mills, the Minneapolis-based company that makes Lucky Charms and other cereals, said its own investigation has not found any evidence of consumer illness linked to Lucky Charms. General Mills said it is working with the FDA and encourages consumers to report any illness or concerns. The FDA added, quote, the FDA takes seriously any reports of possible adulteration of a food that may also cause illnesses or injury. Complaints of a less serious nature or those that appear to be isolated incidents are monitored, and the information may be used during a future inspection of a company to help the FDA identify problem areas in a production plant. End quote. You're listening to a spring membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. We'd like to remind you that you can renew your KBOO membership or become a member at any time during this program by going online to kboo.fm/give. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview with the nonprofit Street Roots about developers' role in housing stock in Portland, followed by Noise Filter. Then at 6, it's Transpositive PDX, and at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with a low of 38 degrees. Tomorrow will be rainy with a high of 50 degrees. Today in history, in 1775, the American Revolution begins at the Battle of Lexington. The first battles of the American Revolution led to a conflict that would escalate from a colonial uprising into a world war that 7 years later would give birth to the independent United States of America. The quote of the day is from American linguist, philosopher, and political activist Noam Chomsky, who said, quote, "It is important to bear in mind that political campaigns are designed by the same people who sell toothpaste and cars," end quote. A federal judge shoots down the CDC's public transit mask mandate. The Supreme Court rejects an appeal in a life-and-death case alleging a racist juror. And last-minute redistricting shakes up two swing states. With more on the story, it's Jonah Chester with 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we are following our democracy in historic times.
We would say to anyone sitting out there, we'd recommend you wear masks on the airplane.
A federal judge has struck down the CDC's mask mandate for planes, trains, and buses, which was due to expire but expanded 2 weeks as COVID cases nationally tick slightly upward. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki.
What we announced last week was just a two-week extension in order to have time to assess. What we've all seen is rising cases and make an assessment and recommendation with that in mind. So, of course, it's disappointing.
Due to the ruling, the New York Times reports the TSA won't be enforcing the mask mandate for the time being, and officials are weighing whether or not to appeal the decision. The Supreme Court has denied the appeal of a black death row inmate in Texas who claimed a juror in his trial was racially biased. In a minority opinion on the 6-3 decision, Justice Sonia Sotomayor wrote racial biases in a jury, quote, deprives a defendant of his right to an impartial tribunal in a life or death context, unquote. Florida lawmakers returned to the Capitol today to approve a redistricting plan drafted by Republican Governor Ron DeSantis, who vetoed an earlier GOP plan. Ellen Frieden of Fair Districts Now says DeSantis's plan will break two congressional districts with a high population of voters of color.
He's really totally disregarding all the voters of Florida, and in particular, black voters in the two districts. He's cutting black representation in Florida in half.
Meanwhile, the Wisconsin Supreme Court Friday approved a legislative redistricting plan drafted by GOP lawmakers. The state's high court previously approved legislative maps submitted by Democratic Governor Tony Evers, but the U.S. Supreme Court overturned that decision, holding the state court didn't provide satisfactory justification a new black majority assembly district in the Evers plan was necessary. Attorney Mel Barnes argued the Republican maps likely violate the Voting Rights Act, opening them up to further litigation.
The purpose of legislation like this that grew out of the civil rights movement and was a triumph that people around this country organized for and pushed for was to make sure that we weren't drawing districts in a way that diluted these votes.
Milwaukee County will now have 5 state assembly districts with a majority of black voters, down from the current 6 and the 7 Evers sought. And the White House held its first in-person Easter event in 3 years Monday after 2 years of pandemic-driven cancellations. First Lady Jill Biden dubbed this year's role Eggucation and encouraged participants to engage in educational opportunities scattered across the White House's South Lawn.
Education never stops. The determined spirit of education is what we wanted to honor in this Easter egg roll.
According to White House historians, the annual egg roll began during the presidency of Rutherford B. Hayes in the 1870s. I'm Jonah Chester for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Shareholders of Sealaska will vote in June on whether or not to get rid of a blood quantum requirement for descendants. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is recognizing the health disparities faced by Alaska Natives and Native Americans, and the Cherokee Nation in Oklahoma recently revised its Public Health and Wellness Act in order to build drug treatment facilities. With those stories and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Shareholders of Sealaska will vote in June on whether or not to get rid of a blood quantum requirement for descendant shareholders. Sealaska is the regional Alaska Native Corporation of Southeast Alaska. When the corporation was formed under the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, or ANCSA, only Alaska Native people in Southeast Alaska who were already born could be shareholders. Those people are original shareholders. In 2007, those shareholders voted to allow their descendants to enroll, but only if they had had 1/4 blood quantum and had proof of it on a certificate of Indian blood from the U.S. government. D-Alaska surveyed its shareholders last year, and more than 2/3 of the respondents said they want to get rid of the blood quantum requirement. 4,000 shareholders took the survey, which is around 17% of C-Alaska's 23,000 shareholders. In the survey, people who want to get rid of the requirement say it's keeping their children and grandchildren out of the corporation, and it's keeping them from learning about their culture. They say that blood quantum is a colonial construct created by the federal government to erase Native people, and that's not how Native people identify themselves. People who took their survey also have concerns with letting more shareholders in because it will dilute their stocks and dividends will be smaller, and they don't want smaller dividends to negatively impact elders. If the requirement is eliminated, Sea Alaska estimates about 10,000 more people would be eligible to enroll. Shareholders will be able to vote online in May up to Sea Alaska's annual meeting in June. The meeting will be live streamed and in person in Juneau. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is recognizing the health disparities faced by Alaska Natives and American Indians, and efforts to advance health equity and observance of National Minority Health Month. Dr. Shea Welch is Senior Policy Advisor for the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Welch says while racial and ethnic minority groups have experienced high rates of COVID-19, hospitalizations, and deaths, the inequities for Native people have been longstanding.
The inequities that, you know, we're looking at those social determinants of health have historically prevented us as having the same opportunities for economic, physical, emotional health. I mean, look at our suicide rate and our substance use rate. It was sky high prior to this pandemic, and look at it now.
Welch says drawing attention to one month to really focus on minority health is a way to examine the social determinants of health, including how limited economic opportunities, limited health services, limited or poor housing conditions impact the health of Native people.
It's all interconnected, as we all know. Everything is related. So I think it's important that we focus on this. I'd like to focus, and we will be focusing on it more than one month out of the year, but for sure calling it out.
April is National Minority Health Month. The Cherokee Nation in Oklahoma recently revised its Public Health Wellness Act in order to build drug treatment facilities. The tribe is using opioid settlement funds to help improve the overall wellness of Cherokee citizens. The signing of the revised law earmarks $15 million over the next 3 years for construction. The Cherokee Nation has finalized a settlement with drug distributors and has a tentative agreement with the drug maker. Those are worth millions of dollars. The tribe is evaluating how to use the opioid settlement funds for other projects, including for behavioral health. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
A winter storm in Texas in 2021 left over 4 million homes and businesses without electricity. Data shows that people of color disproportionately lost power during the freeze. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. In February 2021, more than 4 million homes and businesses lost power after severe winter storms swept across Texas. In the cold, electricity demand spiked, and some power sources failed. To keep the whole system from going down, grid operators implemented blackouts. People of color experienced a disproportionate share of the power outages, according to research from the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory.
There's a sense that some of these natural disasters affect everyone equally. And the truth is that we're finding that, at least in the case of Texas, that was really not the case.
Juan Pablo Carvalho and his team analyzed satellite images of nighttime lights to learn which communities lost power. They correlated this information with demographic data about each neighborhood. They found that areas with high minority populations were about 3 times as likely to have experienced a blackout than majority white areas. The disparities were far more closely linked to race than income. Carvalho did not investigate the specific causes of the disparity.
Our research was aimed at diagnosing what had happened.
So he says more studies are needed to understand how to prevent this inequity as climate change causes more extreme weather. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
Earlier this month, President Joe Biden said evidence needs to be gathered to put Russian leader Vladimir Putin on trial for war crimes related to his nation's invasion of Ukraine. The International Criminal Court has already begun investigating whether war crimes are taking place, and Ukraine has also set up a team to gather evidence. This comes as other acts of mass violence continue across the world, specifically against the Rohingya people of Myanmar and Uyghurs in China. Now we go to global citizen commentary on the issue from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
In just the past few years, we have witnessed mass violence directed at innocent people in many places. China's Xinjiang province, the Saudi-led war in Yemen, the Myanmar junta's atrocities against the Muslim Rohingya people, and of course, Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Each of these episodes has its distinctive characteristics, but they all violate international law and our common humanity. None of them can be excused by arguments based on state sovereignty, national security, historical analogy, or the sins of others past and present. Crimes of war come in three categories: war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocide. The victims of mass violence have legal outlets through the International Court of Justice, the ICJ, the International Criminal Court, the ICC, special tribunals, and regional human rights courts, such as the European Court of Human Rights. Thus, the ICJ considered Ukraine's complaint in response to the Russian claim of genocide by Ukraine forces, can you imagine, in the Donbass region. By a 13-2 vote, with the Russian and Chinese judges dissenting, the court ruled that Russia, quote, shall immediately suspend military operations that it commenced on 24 February 2022 in the territory of Ukraine. Russia never attended this ICJ hearing, claiming the court lacked jurisdiction. The ICJ's opinion is binding under the UN Charter, but Russia was undeterred. The U.S. charge that Putin and Russian military forces are guilty of war crimes might go before the ICC. The Swiss lawyer Carla Del Ponte, who was chief prosecutor in the Rwanda and Bosnian Serb international tribunals, has called Vladimir Putin a war criminal and urged that a warrant be issued for his arrest. Note that the U.S. and Russia have never signed or ratified the 1998 Rome Statute that established the International Criminal Court. But any state that has signed it can refer Russian violations to the ICC, and 39 countries have done so. According to the Rome Statute, Russia's military has in fact committed many crimes, in particular forced deportation to Russia, imprisonment of Ukraine government personnel, use of children as shields, persecution of a population, attacks on civilian facilities, use of prohibited weapons such as cluster munitions, and endangerment of a nuclear complex. The massacre of civilians in Bucha this month raised the question of genocide. Russia may also be found guilty of committing a war of aggression, a charge that cannot apply to a state that has not accepted the International Criminal Court and may therefore require formation of a special tribunal. Interestingly, Russia's charge of genocide in Ukraine got turned around by Ukraine, enabling the International Court of Justice to investigate and rule on Russian genocide. As a state that has ratified the Genocide Convention, Russia has put itself in the untenable position of being a genocide state. The ICJ's ruling in March is a temporary one. The investigation continues, with more and more evidence piling up in civilian bodies and mass graves to make the charge of genocide credible. One option for bringing pressure on an aggressor state is international condemnation. In the UN, Russia was able to escape such a resolution in the Security Council by vetoing it, but it could not prevent a similar resolution from passing almost unanimously in the General Assembly. International law, though without enforcement mechanisms, is proving as effective as condemnations. In the absence of use of force against Russia, both law and censuring are important tools. As one authority writes, international law remains one of Ukraine's most powerful weapons against Russia. The law is helping states that agree on little else unify in opposition to the invasion. The law has brought together an unprecedented global coalition of states to oppose the Russian intervention and forge a program of sanctions that will raise the costs of the Kremlin's aggression. As an American, it is not easy to condemn the atrocities of others when the United States has been guilty of mass violence in many places, from the atomic bombings in Hiroshima and Nagasaki to its interventions in many parts of the world. Leaders of great powers, however, rarely appear before the bar of justice to answer for their crimes or even have to apologize for them. Nor does calling out the crimes against humanity of others lessen one's own guilt. Still, calling attention to U.S. war crimes cannot exonerate the war crimes of others. All such crimes deserve exposure and, whenever possible, punishment. All national leaders who decide on or acquiesce in criminal behavior must be called to account. The highest purpose of international law is to protect human life and dignity against the power of the state. I'm Mel Gertov for The Global Citizen. Thanks very much for listening.
You're listening to a spring membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, April 19th, 2022. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Mel Gertov and Josh Salem. The producer is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Jonah Chester, Eric Tegedoff, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/evening news. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu. All of these KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. KBOO is currently in our spring membership drive. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for an in-depth interview with Street Roots on developers' role in housing stock.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
To start, would you